You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. There are lots of ways to gamble in LA and the rest of Southern California without having to go to Vegas. Think tribal casinos, card clubs, racetracks, and don't forget the state lottery. And because of a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 2018, we could see even more.
Breaking news, the Supreme Court this morning striking down the federal ban on sports betting. Now it leaves it up to the states.
In the years since the High Court's decision, more than two dozen states have legalized sports gambling. And California could be next. But many folks are worried about the problems that legal sports betting could create. KQED's Saul Gonzalez of the California Report's been looking into this, and he brings us this story.
If you want to wager legally on sports now in California, you basically have one choice: horse racing. Like the bets placed here at the storied Santa Anita Park Racetrack in Arcadia.
Smoke 'em for you, hugs the rail, paddle on Polly, these two are head and head.
The track opened in 1934, only 1 year after horse racing became legal in California. Nearly a century later, Santa Anita still attracts devoted fans of racing and betting, with the most devoted coming during the midweek afternoon races. There are people like Stanley Duran. For him, the track is a home away from home.
I mean, I can stay here all day. I'm a retired man.
How often are you here at Santa Anita at the track?
All the time.
All the time.
I mean, I like to gamble. It's entertainment for me. More gambling, more fun, that's for sure. Yeah.
But sports betting in California could soon explode far beyond the racetrack, with legal wagering allowed on pretty much all professional and college competitions. From the gridiron...
Touchdown, L.A., 79 yards.
To the back nine.
This for birdie. See if he's got that figured properly. Oh, you can't get any closer.
To the baseball diamond.
Driven to center field. Ball game over.
A ballot measure backed by Native American gaming tribes that would allow sports betting in reservation casinos and horse racing tracks has qualified for the November ballot. Meanwhile, a competing measure that would allow online gambling that you could do from your smartphone anywhere and anytime has also qualified for the ballot. The mobile gambling measure is backed by online sports betting companies like FanDuel and DraftKings. They say they're ready to spend more than $100 million to pass it. Here at Santa Anita, gambler and sports fan Daniel Chavez loves the idea of being able to bet on something other than horses.
I think it's awesome that we can bet on any kind of sports. It's not hurting nobody. You know, if you want to make your money, you should be able to spend it the way you want, whether it be on horse races, NFL.
Basketball, hockey.
Basketball, yeah, anything like that. Yeah, you should be able to spend your money however way you want. I think it's great.
But there is a group of Californians who deeply fear the prospect of sports betting becoming legal in the state and the damage it could do to their lives. They're recovering gambling addicts, like a man we're going to call Harold A.
Well, it's a disease, okay? It's compulsive addictive behavior, okay? And it's no different than other compulsive addictive behaviors. This is something that can be arrested but can never be cured.
Harold, who's been in recovery for decades with the help of Gamblers Anonymous, says his addiction nearly destroyed his life as debts mounted and family ties broke.
I was the hamster on the wheel. I was running from, you know, from the card room to the racetrack to the cocaine dealer. I mean, I had every seat on the Titanic, as they say, in recovery. And no seats were any good, that's for sure.
Harold fears legal sports betting could tempt him and others in addiction recovery back to reckless gambling.
My reaction personally is I'm worried.
Harold's also worried about a new generation of gambling addicts being created, lured into sports betting by the ease of mobile wagering, combined with glossy marketing campaigns. The gambling industry has already unveiled in other states. The campaigns feature a who's who of Hollywood and sports celebrities, like Ben Affleck, Kevin Garnett, Drew Brees, and Jamie Foxx, all hawking the rush of sports betting.
You want to make every game interesting? Step one, open the BetMGM Sportsbook. Step two, put some skin in the game. And step three, showtime.
But if sports betting is legalized in California, how big of a problem could problem gambling become? Dr. Timothy Fong is co-director of UCLA's Gambling Studies Program.
We know that approximately 1% of the state of California has a gambling disorder. Now, 1 out of 100 people doesn't sound like a lot, but that's about the same percentage of men and women with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or severe psychosis in the state of California.
And Fong says if sports gambling becomes legal in California, especially easy to use and convenient mobile betting, addiction rates could double.
You go from a 1% state of California having gambling disorder, and now you go to 2%. You know, that's millions of lives that have now been wrecked. Millions of lives have been severely damaged. And at what cost? And when people say, well, who's at risk? Well, anyone who gambles. But the most vulnerable populations are who you would exactly expect to be at risk for any addiction. People with untreated depression, untreated psychiatric conditions, the poor, people who have histories of trauma, people with family history of addiction. These are the communities that are most at risk when gambling expands.
So, what is or could be done about an increase in gambling addiction?
You've reached the California Problem Gambling Helpline. To speak directly with a counselor for help with gambling problems, press 1 for English.
The California Department of Public Health has an Office of Problem Gambling. Its director is Robin Christensen.
So the Office of Problem Gambling offers a range of confidential, no-cost services to support problem gamblers and other individuals who've been affected by the gambler's behavior. We are referring you to clinicians, to therapists, to licensed mental health professionals within the state of California.
I tried to ask Christensen what the state is doing to prepare for a possible future where sports gambling is legal and fueling higher addiction rates, but was interrupted by a department spokesperson.
We're getting into hypotheticals.
Yeah.
After I asked again in emails, I was told the Department of Public Health is consulting with other states that have legalized sports gambling about their experiences with addiction, but no details were provided. We'll note that California's $4 million a year gambling addiction budget is completely bankrolled by the gambling industry. Recovering gambling addict Harold A. thinks that creates a conflict of interest and that the $4 million from the industry is peanuts.
The way I see it, Saul, is that they're doing the minimum. You know, $4 million? What's $4 million? That's a drop in the bucket, okay? I mean, it really is. And, you know, we're talking about billions of dollars. This is a billion-plus dollar industry.
Meanwhile, with sports betting measures on the November ballot, the gambling industry is trying to build wider political and public support. The backers of the ballot measure that would legalize mobile betting say they'll use revenue earned to fund housing and mental health programs for the state's homeless. That's earned legal sports gambling the support of some California mayors, like Robert Garcia, the mayor of Long Beach.
For us, it's all about homelessness dollars. When we heard that this initiative was looking at putting dollars into homelessness ongoing for services and that cities would get substantial revenue, I think a lot of the mayors were like very interested in this.
That's what matters to you.
100%. That's the game changer for cities.
Gambling industry critics say whatever betting revenue is spent on fighting homelessness isn't a good trade if it leads to more addiction. Critics also say the money would just be a tiny fraction of what the industry could earn in the state. If sports gambling does become legal in California, one study predicts $30 billion in bets could be wagered annually. That's why the gambling industry calls the state the holy grail of sports betting. For KCRW, I'm Saul Gonzalez.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It has happened only twice in LA in the last quarter century, the ousting of an incumbent in a Los Angeles City Council election. But that's what Anicis Hernandez did to Gil Cedillo, a city council member with 9 years on the dais representing District 1. After a campaign that involved more than 60,000 door knocks, Hernandez beat the odds and beat Cedillo by about 2,400 votes. While this will be Hernandez's first time serving in a political office, she is no stranger to local politics. She was a leader in the fight to stop a $3.5 billion jail expansion in L.A. County, and she helped pass Measure J in 2020, which funds community programs and alternatives to incarceration. She's going to be sworn in December, but ahead of that, she joins us right now to talk about it. Councilmember-elect Anicis Hernandez, welcome to you. Congratulations to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
As I said, you have been an activist, very active for that matter, in your district. What made you want to become a politician?
What made me want to become a politician is seeing the struggles of my community, especially during COVID-19. You know, the political window was open for our leaders to really take some direct action on helping those folks who have been most left behind, our lowest income communities, our migrant communities, and still those communities had to play a lot of defense just to even be heard. That was one of the last straws that broke the camel's back, where I felt that we needed, you know, something to change, because a lot of my community members were not going to survive another 4 years under the same leadership.
What was it like to run a campaign like this as a political newcomer? Had you ever run for office before?
I've never run for office before, and it was very hard. But, you know, we had an amazing group of people working on our campaign. Most of our canvassers were either from the district or displaced from the district. Women of color, queer women were leading my campaign. We had a phenomenal fundraising team that, you know, most of our donations came from community. Average donation was less than $80, and we took no money from special interest groups and even refunded thousands of dollars that we got in donations from special interest groups, especially from developers and real estate, because we wanted to be only accountable to community and to those most vulnerable in our communities.
You are not the only progressive candidate that fared well against an incumbent in the primary. I mean, why do you think there's such an interest in getting fresh faces into office right now?
You know, a lot of the folks who have been in office have been there for nearly a decade or more. Community members understand that the situations that they're in are because of a lack of leadership or because of the people who currently represent them. And so I do believe that folks are interested in a different vision and, you know, solutions that are applicable, that are practical, and people who are willing to do the work. Because right now what we're hearing a lot is that, you know, the incumbents are inaccessible. You know, we cannot get a hold of them.
How do you not do that? How do you become accessible? You say accessibility is a big deal, right, when you move to City Hall, but sometimes it's unavoidable, right? You get busy and there's a lot going on. How do you stay in touch with your community? I mean, you grew up in Highland Park, right?
I've lived in Highland Park my whole entire life, and I believe that the way that we stay connected with community is by doing a couple things. One is to continue to canvass. Over 60% of my district are people who are renters, who are tenants. We want to do renter advocacy and renter rights education, and that's going to require us to continue to knock on doors. So meeting people where they're at, both in their homes, but also digitally, in their hands, figuring out how we can get information to them in their languages, which was something we also really focused on in our campaign, making sure that all of our materials were either in Cantonese or in Spanish or Korean, and that we had special teams for special neighborhoods like Chinatown and MacArthur Park, so that the information could be accessible to community.
You've worked a lot on criminal justice reform. Are you going to be continuing to do that as a council member?
Creating more access to mental health services, drug treatment, those are things that I believe are public safety and are a part of our public safety platforms, including mental health crisis teams. Yes, criminal justice reform and, you know, the work that I've done, which is, you know, creating access to alternatives to incarceration, is what we're going to do and continue to do at the city level.
You've talked about the complicated relationship that you had with law enforcement growing up in L.A. in the Highland Park area. How did those experiences shape you and your politics? And what do you think is the future of law enforcement, or is there a future of law enforcement, police?
You know, my relationship at one point is that I wanted to be a police officer. When I applied to college, I applied to schools for criminal justice programs because that's what I wanted to do. I felt that I could be the officer that when I needed help and I called 911 for different situations, that I would have been supportive. But I had situations where that was not the case. And I saw friends of mine who were whose lives were ruined because of marijuana. And so when I graduated, I started working on policy. I really believe that there are things that we can do better. You know, other cities, other countries are light years ahead of us on the responses to open air drug use. There are responses to sex work, even mental health crisis response teams. We need to expand them. They exist here. The tires exist. We just need to put air in them. And I want to focus on that.
Do you support the movement to, quote, defund the police?
You know, no other moment in history have we given LAPD more money than we do today. And so I believe that we are in a moment where we need to reassess the way that we are spending our money. You know, if an employee or staffer is not doing their job or being harmful, you know, there are policies to addressing that. And it's not by giving them more money. And so I do feel that we are in a moment as a city that where we need to be fiscally responsible and need to reassess the way that we're spending our money and seeing if we're getting our bang for our buck or if we need to start heavily, you know, investing in mental health crisis response teams to begin with.
Gentrification has been a big topic of discussion in Council District 1 just recently. Tenants' rights advocates were protesting an expensive restaurant in Glassell Park. How do you plan to navigate that very complicated issue and issues, by the way, that are happening in other council districts as well?
Yes, it's an issue that, you know, Highland Park, where I've grown up in, has been dealing with for over a decade. We've seen a lot of the development and the investment and a lot of the displacement that has come with that. And that has caused a lot of trauma. And so I believe that there needs to be, you know, transformative justice conversations between the businesses and the neighbors. Because if the neighbors feel harmed, folks need to get to the root cause of that. And I think that also businesses and other folks who are coming into these communities who are, you know, being impacted by gentrification need to come in with the conscience of, okay, how do we connect with community? How do we have community engagement in the project that we're trying to, you know, place in this community?
You have a couple of months to sort of take a deep breath, right, before you're sworn in December. What are you going to do between now and then?
Oh, you know, we're just taking one quick breath in July. And then, you know, in August, we start, you know, strategizing and building up our team, figuring out how we'll work in City Hall, how we'll, you know, build out our community district offices. And I hope folks plug in to support the other campaigns that are going and leading up to November, because I myself cannot do it alone. But if we add another three people on there, I think we will make a big impact in City Council. So stay tuned, people, and stay plugged into November.
It is exciting, and congratulations to you, Anesis Hernandez, the council member-elect for L.A. City Council District Number 1. Thank you so much for joining us. Again, congratulations to you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate y'all. Take care.
Moving on with Greater L.A. now on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Whether you're in the mood for drinks or have a job serving those drinks, your plan for imbibing could be in for a few changes coming up. For one, you could go out a lot later in West Hollywood and a handful of other cities if a bill that's making its way through the legislature ultimately passes and gets signed. It would allow bars to keep serving later, and WeHo is already on board with this. And a new program here in California means you're going to have to be certified to pour those drinks behind the bar. Here to tell us more is Mona Holmes. She's a reporter at Eater LA, of course, one of our regulars here at GLA. Hey, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
So let's start with this new certification that everyone who serves alcohol has to complete. What is this?
Sure. So the Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control, they issued a requirement, and it's a state law that goes into effect on July 1. And the short answer is that ABC is making sure that everyone in the state who's serving alcohol gets proper training. And by training, that's all designated for servers, managers, bartenders. They've got to get the certification. And there's a lot that has to happen when you serve alcohol, from checking IDs, taking orders, pouring and delivering alcoholic beverages. ABC just wants to make sure that everyone has proper training to do it.
So this is a certification. You said it's already in effect. 1st of July. So how long do bars and restaurants have to make sure that their employees get this done?
They've got until August 31. And if there's anyone who's hired after that deadline, they have 60 days to complete that training.
And the training is what? Going online? Do you have to go somewhere? Is it like Napa Valley? Is it a wine trip?
Well, let me tell you, for those who have to do the training, here's how they'll get it done. You can complete this training online. And apparently it's a very easy process. Employees have to go online, get a profile, take the test, and have to pretty much have 30 days to get 70% or better.
All right. Let's talk about the last call bill. This is Senate Bill 930 that has not passed. But if it does pass, well, the city of West Hollywood's already passed it in their own right, right? To take the last call from 2 a.m. to 4 a.m., right?
That's correct. I'm very interested in seeing how this all plays out. So the city council just last week approved their own pilot program moving forward. And like you said, that will extend all nightlife operations until 4 a.m. But the pilot program is not just for West Hollywood. It's also for Cathedral City, Palm Springs, Coachella, San Francisco, Oakland, and Fresno.
You call it a pilot program because it does expire. So it would go into effect, I think, in 2025. Is that right? And then it would expire after 5 years.
That's correct.
Why has there been these political headwinds for a piece of legislation like this? I mean, California, you would think they would, you know, hey, let's have fun and, you know, be able to drink past 2 a.m.
For a state that's got a high level of tourists coming here, you would think that for sure. But the opposition to this is fierce. It's not only law enforcement groups, but it's also alcohol industry watch groups that are not fans of it. And also, apparently, during the West Hollywood City Council meeting, a lot of people who have lived in the area for a long time are highly opposed to it. They're worried about more drunk drivers. They're worried about more drug use. They're worried about their streets being unsafe with more drunk people. So I would say that that is a huge part of it, of this not being able to get past the state legislature.
All that fun deep into the night has a toll, right? It takes a toll.
It takes a toll, but there's benefits to it. Businesses, especially clubs and bars, who can serve more alcohol, that means more sales. The return on alcohol sales is really what keeps restaurants and bars and clubs profitable. So there's that. There's rideshare companies that will have more riders, food vendors, those bacon-wrapped hot dog vendors. You know, anyone who is looking for something to eat after a night of drinking. But there's another element too, Steve. A lot of these bars that I've spoken to over the years who love this legislation, they've always been concerned about people getting kicked out at 2 a.m., last calls at 1 a.m., and then they get kicked out at 2. They've been wanting to be able to extend this so that they believe that there's a better safety concern by making this permanent.
Mona, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Mona Holmes, reporter at Eater LA, a regular here on Greater LA. Mona, thanks.
I had to.
As always, Steve, it's a pleasure.
That's it for today. Next week, what can the next LA mayor actually do about homelessness and a new streetcar line in Santa Ana? But its construction has put local businesses on the rails. Those stories and more next week on Greater LA. Visit the website, kcrw.com/GLA. How are you doing? Give us some story ideas. Subscribe to the podcast, too, all at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Juliana Mayo, Rebecca Ludman, Zoe Matthew, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Nick Lampone, Amy Ta, Christine Comito, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all made today's episode possible. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for the ears. Have a great night.